Welcome to another episode of the Veterans in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. I'm your host, Mike Dessau, and here we explore the stories and insights from the military veteran and supporter communities who are leading the way for vets in agribusiness, ag tech, and agripreneurship. We swap stories, talk ag, and show how the grassroots nature of the ag community can be a natural fit for the military veteran. My guest today is John Castellaw, co-founder and CEO for Farm Space Systems and a retired Marine Corps three-star general. For 36 years, John led Marines around the world, from a unit of 40 young men and women to a Marine aircraft wing of over 7,000. He flew more than two dozen different aircraft during his tenure, served as the UN staff during the Siege of Sarajevo, executed humanitarian operations all over the world, including Asia, Africa, and Europe, and commanded the American forces in stability and security operations in East Timor. John also served as the Chief of Staff for the U.S. Central Command during the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It was so impressive to see how far agriculture had come over the years through John's stories, from driving mules to mechanization to the broader adoption of ag tech. Even more impressive, I think, was his realization that we can't keep beating the dirt into submission. We need to adopt more regenerative and sustainable practices, a sentiment not always shared by multi-generational farmers. John takes me through his upbringing in West Tennessee, where he resides now, and how these experiences drove him into service and ultimately led him back to the farm after nearly 40 years. This interview is filled with nuggets tied up in stories, such as ag is a component of national security, the importance of servant leadership, and the military's advances in technology, which are being more widely adopted within agriculture. My favorite story involved a well drilling unit and a veterinarian in East Africa. Have a listen. Find out how it ends. John, I was hoping we could start at the beginning. I know that your educational background is in general agriculture from the University of Tennessee at Martin, but I'm really interested to know a little bit more about what type of upbringing leads a man to spend nearly 40 years in the Marine Corps and then head into a profession like agriculture that's arguably as equally challenging in many ways. Can you provide some insight for us as to that upbringing?
Well, sure. It's pretty simple. I come from a long line of dirt farmers and livestock traders. My father was a farmer and grandfather, and we traced our lineage back to Eastern North Carolina, and that's what they did there, farm. They came across the mountains in the 1830s when West Tennessee was opened up for settling, and settled in this area and farm. So when I went to the University of Tennessee, I expected to come back to the farm after I got my degree. I have said that, when they asked me what I wanted to do after I completed my initial training, where you choose what you're going to do in the Marine Corps, I said, well, give me something big and green, runs on diesel, makes a lot of smoke and noise like it's not here. And so I went in Marine Corps armor to begin with, and did a couple of tours and Amtraks and tanks. And my last ground tour, I was advisor to a Marine tank unit at Miramar. And there were all these airplanes flying over my head. And I said, I always wanted to fly. Why not? So I applied for flight school and was accepted and became an aviator and flew helicopters. And every time I was planning to get out, and I'd get promoted, or they'd send me to Europe, or some neat deal would come up that involved both myself, my wife, and my son. And so I just never made that decision to get out until I turned around one day and I had 36 years in. And that's what I always expected to do. I came back to the farm. I came back here at Crockett County. I'm the third generation on this farm. I have a old 8N Ford tractor that was built in 1949. My grandfather bought it brand new, and it's never been off this farm. I reconditioned it, and really proud of it.
I have never heard of that type of transition from a couple of tours in armor and then over into aviation. Was it just a matter of something new?
Well, actually, I'd always wanted to fly. My mother's discouraged me from flying. She had a brother that was working at Firestone in Memphis. And he decided he wanted to fly, so he took flying lessons. And one day he came up with a friend to visit, and this was in 1946, right after World War II. And my grandfather and my mother were plowing mules on a field not far from where I am right now.
No kidding.
And, he buzzed them, pulled it up, stalled it out, and spun it in and killed himself right in front of my my mother. And so she didn't want that to happen. But, you know, I when I was growing up, one of the first things I did to play was that I'd climb up in a tree and I put a 1x12 plank across a couple of limbs, and I flew missions over Swineford, like I said on Bug Out.
Yeah.
So when I, got to Miramar and, they were flying, it just got to the point where I said, well, I understand, Mom, but, I'm going to go try flying. And that's what I did. And I love flying. One of the stories that I tell is that I was flying formation during training at Pensacola, and I was having a heck of a time. I couldn't keep position on the lead aircraft. I was either too close, too far, too slow, too fast. And then, I thought about that old Ford tractor I had 1949 8N. Didn't have a good float system for plowing, so you had to put a little in, take a little out, put a little in, take a little out in order to get the depth right on the braking plow. And so I said, well, let me try that. So I throttled that T-28, and I put a little in, I took a little out, and from then on, I flew welded wing, and I went from getting all below averages to all above averages in formation flying. So, it's funny how some of the things you did growing up, even on a farm, even driving a tractor, helped me out when I was in the military.
I was going to ask you that, growing up on a farm like that can be, I've heard both ways. I have heard it where that is the happiest moment in someone's life where they leave and never come back. But I would say that is the minority of those kinds of star. You leave with joy. And so I'm wondering, from the 1x12 on your back in the top of the tree flying missions, what you remember most about that upbringing and how you kind of think it shaped you into the leader you were in the service and what you took forward with from that background.
Well, I was in the transition from the last of the mules, and actually I got to drive mules when I was growing up. 6 or 7 years old, my grandfather had mules out here on the farm, and so I got to drive old Pete and Bell and book. And then we brought mechanization in to the cotton patch. I had grown up pulling a cotton sack, and we got cotton pickers, and it became a really enjoyable thing to me. I remember on a October night like we're experiencing here in Tennessee, cool, and I'd be alone in the field, and I was on a John Deere 2-row cotton picker, and it was open station. They didn't have cabs back then on that. And it'd get cold, and I'd stuff cotton in my shirt to stay warm. And I knew where the North Star was, and the Little and Big Dipper, and so I would memorize where the constellations were, and the stars were my companions, and that cotton field driving that cotton picker. It was an adventure. I mean, a big machine and a responsibility for doing that. And I really enjoyed it. And so when I went in the Marine Corps, you know, I wanted to continue with something that was a machine that did something. And, you know, that's, I started out in tanks and tracks. And then when I transitioned to the aviation, I was flying, and, you know, the camaraderie of working with the people in the unit, the challenges, you know, when you're a youngster and you've got 20-some odd people in the back. And in my case, a lot of times I was leading a squadron of aircraft doing something, and the responsibilities. And, I had learned those responsibilities and the adventure on that cotton picker on an October night in the 60s.
It's interesting that you mentioned the Constellations and that and how that just resonated so much with you. I can remember I was a young platoon commander in Djibouti. I suspect as you had, and we were out doing a patrolling exercise. I was, one of the platoons in the company, and the other two platoons were in the same sort of area, and we were kind of patrolling against each other. And it was one of the darkest nights I can remember. I mean, no moon. All you had was stars. There was nothing around. And I remember briefing a lost Marine plan as a part of the operational order before we went in. And I remember using the stars as an orientation factor, right? And the North Star, and then you put it on this shoulder, and that's the direction that you go based off of where we are. And we were moving from, I think, one base to the other. And one of the Marines in the back got separated. And we settled into the new patrol base. It was early, early in the morning that night, and my platoon sergeant was doing a head count and realized that we were down one. And I remember thinking, this is the time that we would need to execute the Lost Marine plan. I wonder if he remembered. So I went back to what I had said and where we were and where we had come from. And that's the direction that we started back with a small group of folks to go find him. A couple hours later, he came in from that same direction. And I remember asking him, how did you know which way to go? And he said, well, I remembered what you had said about the Lost Marine plan. And I put that over this place and I walked here. And my company commander found out shortly thereafter, because we notified him during the exercise. And I mean, up one side and down the other, back at the COC tent, the command tent. And he said, what the hell was your Lost Marine? And he was in disbelief, right? And he said, well, which way is that now? And I remember looking up, finding the orientation star. I think it was the North Star. And I turned and I said, that way. And he said, get the hell out of my COC tent. And that was kind of the end of it. But it's interesting to kind of hear you say that that's something that you remembered from your childhood. I didn't grow up on a farm, but I can recall that silent distinction and darkness, you know, in one of those types of situations. That's really interesting. Stepping forward a little, John, that's a really interesting comparison and similarity between the two professions of service to your country and agriculture being a service industry as well, right? In many ways to your countrymen, and a way of life that they enjoy by producing what they wear and what they consume.
Well, I think that agriculture is more than, you know, just an industry or profession. You know, it's essential. You know, it's one of the essential industries. You have to have food. You have to have clothing. You know, we also get energy from it. It is an essential element of our national security. You know, I think too many times, and this really came down to me during my service is that, you know, our leadership depends. Let's send in the Marines or the 101st or the 82nd or send a Kitty Hawk or do something like that. And what we need to do is use all the elements of our national power, which food security is one, to prevent having to deploy the most precious resource we have as a nation, which is the blood of those who serve. And so I look for leadership. I look for on the national scene that look at how all the elements of American power can be employed, not just wait until you send in the Marines.
And how do you see the food security issue, and how do you see that being an element of our national power, in your opinion? Is it something we leverage, or is it something we just need to be conscious of?
Well, it's something that we do. You talked about Djibouti. When I went to Djibouti, I went before, during, and during the fracas over there. I can remember going out to Lumiere before it became a large base, and we had a training unit there was training Djiboutians how to do mining, demining operations, and so forth. And then over my career, I was Deputy Marine Forces Central Command and Chief of Staff, so I spent a lot of time going through Djibouti. But one of the most effective units, task forces, that we had in Djibouti, composed of a well drilling unit, a National Guard well drilling unit, and a veterinarian. Why? Okay, Djibouti, you've been there. You know, the economy out in the rural area is based on goats. You know, how many goats you have determines your wealth. In the villages, you know, the women are responsible for getting the water. So you have a situation where, you know, the women have to walk a couple of miles to a well twice a day to get water to cook with and for other uses. You know, that's a long and arduous journey carrying water. And you know, it's not prone to make you very happy. And, you know, when mama's not happy, nobody's happy. And right. So we also have a situation where, you know, goats, and if they're scrawny, wormy, and, you know, the mortality rate for their offspring is high, then, you know, you're not producing wealth for the economy, and you don't have confidence in the government. So we send that task force in, that well-drilling team, and that veterinarian, and so you drill a well closer to the town, maybe inside the town, so that the women do not have to walk as far to get water. It doesn't take as much time every day to supply the water needs of their families. And then you take that veterinarian and you vaccinate those goats. And they, instead of being scrawny, they put on meat and hair, and they have offspring, you know, the high rate of survival and multiple births and all of that good stuff. And so what you do is you increase the confidence that that village has, you increase the wealth that the people have, you increase the feeling of confidence that the government is looking after them, and you reduce the opportunities for insurgents to get a hold with people who might be, you know, sympathetic to them because they're not getting a good deal either. So, you know, that is really getting down to the nitty gritty, but that is an element of national security, is doing stuff like that. And it doesn't need to be or should be the military. We did it because nobody else was there to do it. It should be USAID. It should be nonprofits. It should be Walmart. It should be all elements of people who can be involved in supporting food security, and by that, our national security. I can tell you one more and I'll try to shut up.
Please. I was going to ask you if there was one more, and if you had something in Iraq or Afghanistan too, that'd be great.
I'll take you to another place. I went to the U.S. European Command, and part of my responsibility in current ops was Africa. That was before AFRICA-COM was was formed. And so they sent me down to Chad when a coup was threatened. So I took a team that included special ops and other folks down and coordinated with the ambassador. I made a plan with for evacuations with the French, who had a presence there. What I saw there was, you know, because of several elements, climate change, the desert coming south was pushing herdsmen from the north, who were mostly Muslim. The fishermen on the Lake Chad were being pushed off into both the herdsmen's area and the farmers, which were around the south. And so what you get is chaos, as you get people competing for increasingly reduced resources, in this case, reduced water availability.
Yeah.
And they've got to feed their family. So they become, particularly when it's also a non-governed space, you give an opportunity for the bad guys to get a hold. I went back 2 years ago.
Really?
And yeah, I've been going back over the last 20 or 30 years. I'm also been involved, supporting visits by congressional delegations.
No kidding.
Going with the UN Foundation to visit some of the areas over there. And I'm also on the board of CNFA, which has contracts with USAID in Africa and other places around the world. So it was an opportunity, again, 2 years ago to go back and look at the area. Lake Chad's keep getting smaller. The insurgency is growing.
So things have not changed for the positive.
Yeah, it's in our interest, you know, to do stuff. You know, one of my favorite activities that are being carried on by non-government organizations is the American Soybean Association in Ghana, okay, which is in Western Africa and
yep.
Not far from that area. You know, they partnered with the locals over there to provide education on feeding chickens. You know, chickens is part of the national security.
Yeah. And
so they help build a feed mill. They help, provide, information on medical support for the farmers and people growing poultry. What does that mean to us? Well, number one is, you know, it helps, again, going back to the Djibouti example, it helps provide confidence in the government. It increases the wealth of the people. It reduces the opportunity for insurgency, and it helps stabilize the country. So, and then, oh, by the way, you know, they buy soybeans, which they do to the chickens. So, all this is just not sending the Marines. It's a lot more than that. And a lot of people have roles to play in agriculture.
It's interesting. Agriculture outside of the United States and outside of many of the developed markets is more than a profession. There's no choice in being involved in agriculture in many parts of Africa as a smallholder farmer. It's the way you survive and subsist. In many of the developed and North American markets, it's not necessarily that way, right? And so I think the perspective that you bring on international agriculture and what can be accomplished by improving that quality of life can have impacts here in the U.S. for sure. And so I think that's a really strong point that, you know, any veteran that had deployed to any one of the places that you had just mentioned and had seen firsthand what happens when you don't care for a goat herd, right? Or when you accidentally, one of those herds or one of the goats within those herds or animals is killed or maimed in a bombing or whatever the case may be, that's more than just an economic detriment to that herder, right? That's a blow to their subsistence and could be their survival. So bringing that sense of how these things, the gravity of those, of that profession that a veteran sees internationally, bringing that forward post service for them into the ag space, in any part of the ag space, production, technology, downstream, I think is, that's really hard to put a value on.
And again, you know, with veterans, you know, regardless of whether they, like me, were, you know, came from a rural area or like you, didn't come off a farm, you know, you come out with some great technology. You know, I've told this story many times, and my wife always tugs on my shirt when I start to tell it. When I got out, my transition job was with a agribusiness company that also had a large farming operation, and they were CIH, you know, Case International. They were red. Okay, and I'm a John Deere guy. Okay,
sure. So everybody has their loyalties there.
Yeah, so I ought to try some John Deere. So I arranged with John Deere to do a technology demonstration, do a equipment demonstration.
Yeah.
So they brought all their equipment out there, and I climbed into one of the sprayers. Man, it was like sitting in the cockpit of one of the aircraft that I flew, you know. Mm-hmm. Yes, we had auto steer, you had links, you know, that told you what was going on with the machine. But the thing that really got me was, you know, as we were spraying, if you turned around and started over your spray track, as you came back over it, the machine would start turning off the nozzles started going to where it had been. And so as I looked at the other pieces of equipment, and then I looked at all the other stuff that was coming along, you know, drones, using satellites, you know, instead of, you know, keeping everything down on a piece of paper and, you know, losing it, you had your computers, and then you were starting to use artificial intelligence. You had the capability to pull in all the weather information and so forth, and said, you know, we have got to really move faster away from beating the ground into submission by this heavy tillage that we do, and we need to do stuff that will, you know, increase the soil health. We need to cover crops. We need to do rotation. We need to do less tillage so that we do not let what carbon and organic matter we have escape, but instead, you know, bring it back in to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases that we've got. And who is perfectly equipped to understand this and to use the technology that's required to do it? But a veteran, somebody that, you know, my favorite group were some Kansas National Guard. Every time as a chief of staff or CENTCOM, I'd go into Baghdad, the group that guarded me and took me around was a group of National Guardsmen from Kansas, you know, and they had tremendous capability. They knew how to use all the technology and et cetera like that. And, you know, and they could go back to the Kansas wheat fields and put it into practice, you know. That we certainly have got to take advantage of that technology that we have and marry it with where we need to go in regenerative and sustainable agriculture and get going.
That's not always the sentiment, though, right? For an older generation coming back to the farm or one that's still farming, you know, I often hear or have heard before, GPS was the end of a bragging right you used to be able to have if you could plow the straightest row, right? And so one of the sentiments is, why, right? Why can't we do this the old school way, right? So what would you say to somebody like that who is hesitant to bring in the kind of technology that FSS brings to the farm and that you just described?
It's all about money.
Yeah, that it can be. Yep.
You know, I I got a good friend here. He's 70 some odd years old, et cetera, you know, and, he buys a planner that's, it costs $300,000, you know, and it's variable rate, you program it, et cetera. But the problem is he doesn't know how to program it. He doesn't have anybody working for him that knows how to program it. He's got a double secret probation number in Jonesboro, Arkansas, that whenever he goes out and they won't put seed in the ground, he calls and, you know, and for $15, this guy, you know, writes him a new program or anything like that. If he's in a real big hurry, what he'll do is he'll just turn off the variable rate piece and plant it like he did in 1960 and waste all the seed. And man, that's another shock to me is how much, seed costs now in relation to what it was back then. So what we're talking about here is using the Goldilocks rule, okay? Just the right amount of the right stuff at the right place at the right time. Don't broadcast it all over just like we used to do. Save money by not spending as much on seed, on fertilizer, on pesticide. And that we're doing it with water too now. You know, being able to apply water more precisely. So it's all about resources are limited. They're becoming limited now because of their cost. And if you want to make money, you know, one of the terrible things about, you know, this year on farmers is 30-40% of their income is government checks. It's not what they made on the commodities, and that's not sustainable. So, you got to be able to use that technology to reduce your costs.
When you came out and you saw all this new technology on the market, what problem did you see within the industry that drove you into starting Farm Space Systems and the drone portion of it? What problem were you trying to solve that you saw that your experience could set you up in a competitive position for?
Well, what we were looking at first is looking at the plant health, is being able to fly over and using the sensors and the programs to try to identify plant health problems before you could see it with your visual eye. Also, you know, we developed the capability to count plants, you know, stand count is, you know, do you have enough plants out there that allow you to not to have to plant over. So, you know, being able to make these decisions that reduce the amount of inputs, and those inputs are fertilizer, pesticides, seed, et cetera, like that. And that's what it's all about is using this technology to get you ahead of it so that you can reduce the amount of inputs, reduce your cost, and at the same time increase your productivity. And so that's what we saw. It's what we still see. Well, some of the things that we're looking at is measuring soil carbon. We are seeing the rise of a carbon market. A lot of companies want to use the opportunity to buy carbon credits from farmers. Okay. And so by using, but one of the problems is it's right now everything is estimate on how much carbon is in the soil to begin with and measuring how much you're putting in by, you know, using cover crops, tillage, conservation tillage means and stuff like that. So what we really need now to support the carbon market is the ability to measure the carbon that exists now so you have a baseline. And then as you do these practices that increase the amount of carbon in the soil, is measure amount that it's increased so you can get paid for it.
I think you're absolutely right, John. The problem with a lot of the renewed interest in ESG today is that the folks who are trying to execute it are stopping short, I think. I think they're putting practices in place, and the extent of that approach stops at the practice, right? You change a grazing habit or you put something down, but what's missing is how much it's actually having the positive effect that you want, right? How much carbon are we actually sequestering from the environment and bringing back into the soil? How much are the practices we're putting in place doing what we want them to do? And the only real way we can tell is through collecting data about it and measurements, right? And I'm excited that it sounds like you guys are on the cusp of, or on the leading edge of, you know, those kinds of new innovations that can begin to do that either in real time or with more accuracy. Because you're right, a lot of it right now is in estimation.
You know, there's some great outfits out there. We're working with NORI. I don't know if you've heard of them, but a good outfit out of the Northwest. Other people are working on the issue too. You know, you hear some people talking about, yeah, we're using satellites. But what they're doing is, you know, they're identifying what cover crop or whatever they're using. They're not actually measuring any soil carbon. Then they take that and whatever crop they see, you know, it's put into the model to estimate how much carbon is being pulled in. But, you know, the technology, in the military, we developed a lot of technology that looks for stuff. We're looking for IEDs, improvised explosive devices. We were looking at certain countries to see what was coming out of the smokestacks so we could try to determine what they were making. Weapons of mass destruction, whatever, you know. So, there's a lot of technology that's been developed in the military, just like, you know, over the years, we've GPS, the internet.
Do those industries, agriculture and defense, share that kind of information? Do they talk well enough? What could they be doing better to bring the technology that the DoD is creating down into what we've already described as an industry that can benefit immensely from increased technology?
Well, you know, we've talked about our VETSA program.
Yeah.
And that's just one program. It's a great program. When we get it started and everything, it's going to be extremely valuable. But
can you describe that, John, to the folks who haven't or are not familiar with the VETSA program?
Yeah, what we are going to do is we've got about 13 or 14 organizations, including Case IH and University of Tennessee Institute of Agriculture, AgriCenter International, Ignipus, Lone Oaks Farm, which is a UTI location, University of Tennessee at Martin, various organization. And what we're going to do is, you know, those veterans coming out with the technology knowledge that we talked about, we're going to focus in on how they're used in agriculture. In our case, at Lone Oaks, we're going to be putting on a program where they'll come in and we'll teach them about remote sensing and how to use drones and remote sensing along with the programs that go along with it. And then after they get through with our program, you know, they're going to know how to use drones in support of agriculture, and they're also going to have their FAA license that allows them to commercially use the drone. So again, you know, it's trying to eliminate that need to call BR-549 in Jonesboro, Arkansas. We want to have those people here in the community ready to help to do that.
And this is in partnership with the USDA, correct?
USDA grant is funding it.
And does the transitioning veteran need to have a technology background in one of these particular areas? Is that ideal?
No. One of the great things about a veteran is that, the reason he's there is because he's flexible. You know,
that's right.
Got great leadership and can accommodate the environment. You know, what I love, you know, the Kansas National Guard guy, you know, he's leading a column of our vehicles, you know, and he's talking to God and everybody on the radios, and he's controlling the column. He's watching for the bad guys, and he's ready to do any number of reaction plans that have been briefed and set on if it gets attacked. Talking about a capability to come into an environment like we have in the civilian community, you know, it's a piece of cake.
I'm certain that there are folks listening to this, whether they've already transitioned or are veterans or active duty folks looking to transition and are inspired by your story and the path that you've taken. Because you have started something from nothing, right? Because you are an entrepreneur within the ag space, what would you tell a veteran coming or a military member coming out of the service that wants to start a new business in agriculture? What would be the biggest piece of advice you would want them to walk away or start their entrepreneurial endeavors with?
You know, there are a lot of great programs with USDA that are focused on the veteran. So, the you know, like we always, what do we do when we go into the fight? You know, we do a study of the terrain and an enemy and, you know, all that other good stuff and everything to know what the environment is. And then we look at what do we have? What resources do we have to use? And where are they available? So, you know, how we approach problems, how we approach starting projects in the military is really plays well with you when you get out. You know, look at the environment, look at what you want to do, do your, you know, your reverse planning and just use the tools that you've learned and the resources that are now available to you to reach that goal.
You heard it, guys. Proper preparation prevents a certain kind of performance, huh? John, how can listeners get a hold of you?
Well, we're Farm Space Systems. We're on Facebook, and our website is FSS Ventures. So just Google us, and we'll pop up.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, John, for being a part of it. I really appreciate it. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Veterans in Ag Podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. This episode with John was about as grassroots as it gets, from flying missions over the swamp as a young boy with a 1x12 strapped to his arms, driving mules, and stuffing fresh-picked cotton in his sweater to keep him warm while on the cotton picker one cool October night. I was struck by just how much of the farm stayed with John throughout his nearly 40-year career in the Corps. To me, this truly highlights just how strong a bond can be created between a farmer and his fields. It's no wonder why the draw to be a part of agriculture following military service is so appealing to veterans. John described, quote, learning the responsibilities of leadership from the adventures of his service. I think such a great way to articulate to a potential employer or someone who's trying to understand more about the military how your experiences in the service prepared you to step into the private sector. I'd encourage listeners to take every opportunity during an interview or a networking event to tell a story which showcases what you've learned, something John did throughout this interview. I really enjoyed how he articulated the connection between agriculture as an element of national power through a simple story involving a well drilling unit and a veterinarian in East Africa. There was so much wisdom tied up in these stories that I'd encourage you to go back and listen to it again to make sure you got it all. I know I will. If you enjoyed this episode and think other military veterans and supporters would benefit from the insights shared by John Castelaw, please leave us a review and share on social media. You can also find these episodes and learn more about AGD Consulting by visiting our website at www.desaconsultingllc.com. That's www.desaconsultingllc.com, and by clicking on our newsfeed. Finally, if you have any recommendations of future guests who are military veterans or supporters who are leading the way in agribusiness, ag tech, or agripreneurship, please send them our way. I'm your host, Mike Bissa, and until next time, stay frosty.